Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. I bet you get 30, 30, I bet you get 30, I bet you get 20, 20, 20, I bet you get 20, 20, I bet you get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month, sold.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Everyone, welcome to another episode of G Thanks Just Bought It, the podcast where we talk about what we just bought and what you might need to buy next. I'm your host, Caroline Moss, and I am recording in my home office, and my guest, Hallie Bateman, is sitting right across from me. Hallie, I'm so excited to have you.
Thank you so much for having me.
This is the most exciting. No one has like ever been in my home before. And if you don't know Hallie, I think you probably know her on Instagram. If you saw her work, you'd be like, oh my God, I know exactly who Hallie is. She is an illust writer. She made up that word. We just talked about it. She is the author of a wonderful book called What to Do When I'm Gone, which you wrote with your mom.
I did.
It's a mother's wisdom to her daughter. I've recommended it to several friends. The day that I bought it when it came out, I could not read it because I got too emotional. It was too emotional.
I hear that a lot. I hear from people who can't bring themselves to read it, and I have to promise them, A, read it whenever you're ready, and yes. B, it's funny. It's a funny book, so there's not like... Don't be too scared. It's funny.
It kind of deals with grief. And, you know, it's you and your mother kind of concocted this sort of blueprint for what you will do after she goes. It's your art and it's your heart also. Like your relationship is here. And I really love that. And the best way that I can describe Hallie's art and work and aesthetic is very similar to, do you remember the Amelia's Notebook series of our youth? It was...
No, I don't think so.
If you're out there and you remember it, please get in touch. It was one of those books where you would race to the library and like try to check it out before someone else in your class checked it out. Cause like it was, I have to pull up.
Is it illustrated?
It's illustrated. It looks like a marble notebook. And it's like a 10-year-old who is writing this notebook and she does this amazing art. And it's like, oh, I taped this eraser into my... And like, it's just...
Oh, I'm so into that.
Let me look. And it kind of reminds me of your work. I'm like looking it up because I just want to show you before we move on with the conversation. And I was obsessed with it. It was very... And then it kind of spun off. There was like a whole series. It was like Amelia's, you know, camp notebook or whatever. But it started as this Amelia's notebook... This was what kind of like what every page looked like. So it was like her journal and it was like pictures of the, you know, oh, we're going on a road trip with my parents and here's a picture of the car. And it just made you want to go out and buy a composition book and be like, I'm going to journal and I'm going to draw. And that's how I felt when I read What to Do When I'm Gone, because it's very much like a reading and then also just really taking in the art experience. But we're not here to talk about that book. Your newest book is out, Directions.
Yeah, Directions just came out in quarantine. Yes. Very, very interesting book release experience. But this is my new baby.
I have it in front of me. This started because what? You had extra construction paper laying around and you were like, I'm just going to use it up by writing stuff on it?
Yeah, my brother was in town and we were just like hanging out and wanted to make art. And so I love to make art sometimes where I have a big stack of paper and it's about filling up the paper and it's not about fixating on, is this brilliant? Is this perfect? It's just fill up all this paper, bitch.
Yeah. I love that process.
So we tore up this construction paper and we were just like drawing and that was the time, I think that was in 2017 when I wrote the first Directions and I had no idea what they were. I just put them in an envelope and like literally was just like, I guess I will not put these in the trash. I will put them in an envelope. And then I stumbled across them a year later when I was moving into a new studio. Uh-huh. And I came, like, I looked at them and I was like, oh, these are kind of funny. Like, I guess I'll share these. And they were, like, shockingly, like, really resonated with people. And it really made me pay attention. It was one of those instances where I would not have continued to make them if people didn't guide me to do that. Yeah. And so it was a really cool experience that felt very magical and, like, collaborative. And it was I mean how often do you literally have people saying, please make more of this, like, and actually being able to, like, listen to that. And so I made more of them and eventually turned it into a book, and
it's crazy.
It exists now.
It's crazy. I feel like so much of especially, you know, you've done books and I've done books, and I feel like when people reach out and have asked for advice, and I'm sure you've gotten this before, it's like, I want to write a book, like, where do I start? You know, what do I do? And there is really no answer to that, like, because there's no magical formula. You really are just, like, whatever you're doing, you really need to believe in what you're doing. Or in your case, too, don't go into it being like, this is going to be a book and all that pressure is on me. Just create and make and write and do, and, like, something will click. But that's really hard advice to give someone. Like, if I got that advice, I'd be like, fuck off.
Totally. Yeah. I mean, I think that there's the answer of how do you make a book, which is one thing. And then that wasn't even what I set out to do with this. I set out to make something that felt good, that was meaningful to people. And then they guided it to be a book, almost. Like, of course I made it, but it was like, I would never have thought of that. And in fact, at one point when, you know, people were commenting, make more, love this, make a book, I was like, I was sitting there like, who are you to tell me what to do?
Like, the book police? Like, the president of
and
books?
It's, there's this sort of feeling where you want to be the originator of every bit of your genius. Like, you want to be, you know, whatever you call it, like, you want to be the mastermind and claim credit. And it's just like, I didn't see, even when I signed with my publisher, I felt that they understood what the book was better than I did.
Yeah.
At this, throughout this process, I've been very much like along for the ride of my own creative creation, like artistic creation. Like, I've been like, oh wow, like, I wonder what this, like, even when it came out, my intention was to find out what it means to people, because I'm learning more, but I didn't fully understand, like, why this thing. And I think I'm starting to understand it, but it's been really interesting.
I mean, it's a wonderful collection of not just advice, but real, I mean, it is, it's directions, it's guidance, it's really good advice for getting from here to there, which is the tagline of this book. I want to echo that there is something to be said when someone's like, oh, you should, especially when you're so close to your work, sometimes you expect, like, well, if it was going to be a book, I would have already thought of that. Like, I would have already, like, sorry, you don't really know what you're talking about. Like, I wouldn't, this would never be a book. Sometimes you're just not. Like, it takes someone looking on the outside to sort of guide you.
I'm realizing that I think I'm wrong about a lot of my work. Like, I think I'm wrong. I've, like, I posted something recently that was like a scrap of something that I didn't think anyone would. I was just like, whatever.
Yeah.
And it was like, you know, performed way better than things that I intentionally was sharing with the idea that people would love it. And I'm just like, I think I'm wrong. I think I need to like widen what I share and just let the universe do what it wants with it, because I think I'm wrong a little.
I like that. I mean, like, that could also just be a direction, you know.
Ooh,
for part two.
Yeah.
I love that also in the back. It's a book you could also just read you know, cover to cover, but also there's an index that is like, you know, if you want directions for caring for your human body, if you want directions for enjoying your one and only life, you have all the page numbers. We love an organized book. I appreciate that. I think that there's also, you know, I love it. I love seeing it all come together. Tell me how you feel about, like, words on a page as art. Like, was there any part of you that felt like, this is an art, this is writing, words on construction paper.
My creative artistic hero, Linda Berry, talks a lot about how writing and art are sort of unfairly separated. And actually, when you pulled up the Amelia book, I thought about her because she draws and makes comics and writes in composition books. Uh-huh. And her work blew my mind when I discovered it in college. And it was just that thing of all the rules you thought you knew being exploded and saying anything is possible. You don't have to start on the left and go to the right, and there doesn't have to be rigid panels, and in fact it can be a fascinating mess. Yeah. And with directions, what I love about it is that the gravity of the words that I'm writing, I feel, are really enhanced and brought to life by the fact that it's written in an imperfect handwriting, and that it's like splashy ink on a page, and it has just a really different effect. And even for me, as like a really visual thinker, as someone with kind of a poor memory, I have to write everything down, and I really like writing things down on actual paper with actual ink.
Yep.
And so I see that, like, there are illustrations in this book.
Yes.
That was something that with my publisher we decided to like have be a part of the book and kind of like distinguish it from just like the online versions of everything. And I think it makes it really special. But I also think that the words, the words on construction paper are really interesting as images too. And kind of like sear their way into your brain, at least for me, a little easier by the fact that they have an aesthetic that's not just like a typewritten word. And sometimes people will repost directions in like, just like a normal font. They'll do like the quote.
Ooh,
and
I'm shudder.
Like, I'm like, why are you?
That's weird.
Just repost the image. Like, yes, the words themselves, you know, have meaning. But I think there's something really cool about a handwritten word and about like seeing these as images.
Yeah. I mean, and also just as someone who creates, you know, your job is to create, and other people can decide how it affects them or what they think about it. And I think that also is difficult as a writer too. And as like someone, I don't like writing nonfiction because I don't want to research. I just want to like lie on the page. It's a lot easier to like make stuff up. Like a lot of people are like, oh, I could never write fiction. I'm like, why? Who cares? Like, it doesn't matter. Like nonfiction is all based in fact. That's so much more work. But it's not up to me, and it's not up to you to be like, oh, like this isn't a book, or like, oh, this isn't an, I mean, when you kind of let go of that, it like really turned into something.
This entire book and the entire series was all about letting go.
Yeah.
My process when I wrote them. So I wrote those with my brother the first time. Uh-huh. And when they were well received, I was like, all right, I'm going to like return to the same process.
Yeah.
So I really developed this like ritual that was much more consistent than any, like, usually I have my, you know, I have my rituals of prepping to draw or whatever, but this was like replicating the same experience each time. And it was tearing up construction paper, dimming the lights, turning on some chill instrumental music, smoking weed, grinding my ink on my inkstone, and just like sitting down and being open to whatever wanted to come out. And because it was a big stack of paper, I think as professional writers experience, I had the experience of the first few things I would write, I would just be like, oh my god, this is horrible.
And you're like performing it almost.
You don't feel like yourself. You're like, you're dissociating. You're like, I should stop. This is really bad.
Yeah. Cause you're already imagining people looking at it.
Yeah.
Which can take you out of the zone of just making something really authentic to yourself.
Exactly. And so that would always happen. And it was so like clockwork that I began to just be, you know, move past that, to ignore the doubt.
Yeah.
And then at the end of it, my office would be like covered in all these construction paper pages that are drying on different surfaces.
Yeah.
And then I would like go through and kind of like pull the ones that I liked. And like that process just repeated many times was how this book came to be. Yeah. And it was something that I've never really experienced, something where it wasn't, I wasn't being rewarded for like active thought and mapping out an idea. I was being rewarded for like fully releasing,
just doing it,
just fully like releasing control. Yeah. And yeah, like, and trying to honestly like come back into my body when I was done writing, right, and then examine what I had put down.
It's that, and that, and that's hard. Like, that's like a very difficult, therapeutic, exhausting process, I think, at times.
It can be hard. It's, I think it's a practice. I think, yeah, it's something that gets easier, and honestly felt like totally magic. I'm just like, wow, oh, I love this. I love how special this feels, and how it's nice to not feel like you're in the driver's seat. Like, it's scary for a second, and then it's like, oh, sweet, we're just in a big, mysterious...
Yeah, Jesus, take the wheel.
Like, exactly. One way I would recommend, if you want to draw but you're nervous, get a big thing of butcher paper, and next time you have a dinner party, paper your table, put out crayons or markers, and everyone or most of them will draw. And it's kind of a safe way to be like, we're going to scrap this at the end. The table will, like, we're going to, like, there's going to be food on it.
No one's gonna see it.
So
right,
it's just for coloring, and then it's in the trash. And
see
just
what
like
happens.
I think that's like a fun, I did that recently, and it was really, really fun.
Oh, I love that. I feel like people are going to take that and run with it.
I hope so.
If you guys end up taking that advice, and if you guys end up taking that direction, make sure you tag me and tag Hallie in the pictures of your butcher paper, and you don't have to feel like you have to Instagram it, just tell us that you did it. Yeah, this is just a wonderful book. I think it's important. It kind of can tell you new things each time you open it. You did a really, really wonderful job.
Oh, thank you.
Congratulations. Oh, and I love this one too. I did want to say this. Focus less on what you liked and disliked. What did you notice? Which I think is great. It's very apt. I recently quit Twitter.
Whoa, congratulations.
Thank you so much. It was a really big part of, I think, how I like established my identity.
Yeah.
In like the space that I wanted to be in for work. And then I realized it wasn't really serving me, so I left. And so far, nothing bad has happened.
How long ago did you leave?
In the beginning of February.
Whoa. Mm-hmm.
The coup, I think, really like did it for me.
Yeah.
I was like, I don't like this experience. Like, not only do I have it streaming on like my phone, the TV, like Dan and I, like, you know, no one did any work that day. Everyone was just watching the TV. And but then also just like Twitter was extremely helpful. I think it helped me establish a voice. It got me a ton of work. It got me a ton of friends. There's a big backstory to how I met Dan, but the first time we really went on a date was because he like pretended that an editor of his was like looking for a writer and like DM'd me, and like and we went from there. So yeah, it got me husband, but something like switched, like, you know, when you feel that internal alarm going off,
like you outgrew it.
I outgrew it. I like just didn't, and maybe I'll go back or whatever. But in that moment, I was like, I don't want this anymore. And it wasn't just like, oh, everyone on Twitter is miserable. It's like it was making me do things I didn't like. Like, oh, a race to like retweet, and maybe like the thing I say will be like the thing that is so prescient about this moment. And I feel like now I have so much more space in my head. But that particular direction about liking and disliking and just noticing, I think, has become a lot easier for me to follow, because Twitter is so much about like, you know, what can we hate today and how much can we hate it. And now that I don't really know what anyone is saying about a television show or a book or a piece of music, I actually can like enjoy things and like form my own opinion without thinking of like how that's going to land. Yeah, it's crazy. It's really crazy. Like, just like, yeah, you don't have to have like a statement or like a big opinion or like a critique of every single thing. And I think that Twitter makes it so. And I also will say, too, that after Trump left office, I saw, you're on Twitter.
Yes.
But you don't spend a ton of time there.
No.
But I think I saw, like, you know, for 4 or 5 years, even longer because of the 2016 election, we all had this like common enemy. And it was like, well, you can always find something that's happening in that circle that's like you can hate and that you can like do a bit on and like make it. And once that was gone, and especially because he like got banned from Twitter, which took long enough.
Right.
I kind of noticed everyone was just trying to grasp at like, well, what do we do now? Like, this was the last 6 years of like, you can always count on Betsy DeVos to like spell something wrong. She's the education secretary. Like, you can always count on like these people to be COVID deniers, like anti-vax. Like, that's very, it's easy. That's like, it's low fruit, you know? Like, if you are kind of in this circle of people who all don't split hairs over like the biggest topics, it is all just jokes and ragging. And then all of a sudden, like, that's been wiped. And people, it just, I just saw like,
I think it's like we lost a drug that was intoxicating us, that was like, that was just rising everything to the level of extremism, which is what the whole Trump era was about. And like, all sides got swept up into how extreme everything could be.
Yeah.
And I think it's interesting that you point out that direction in this context, because I just think that the love, hate binary being applied to everything is a way to fucking miss out on your whole life.
Yes.
And it's a way to go around labeling everything, being emotionally pulled in different directions, and like missing the details and missing out on just having a moment where you're just a human being witnessing something, forming your own thoughts, and maybe like waiting a beat before just saying, I hate this, and that's how I'm going to act about it.
Yeah. Yeah, 100%.
Which I am totally guilty of.
We all
and that's
are.
Why I wrote that, because I'm
the
guilty
of our own like movies. You know, we're all the leading players in our own plays, and you know, we're all the stars of our own musicals or whatever. Some things we're not made for me, and
most things
yeah, like just a few things were not made specifically with me in mind. But I and it's okay to just be like, hey, I don't like this, and that the only thing that says is that it's not for me. It doesn't mean that it's bad. It doesn't mean that I have to like shout it out to 50,000 people. And there is this drug of Twitter, like the Barclays Center in Brooklyn fits 19,000 people. And I Googled that in respect to the way that I thought about Twitter. And I had 50,000 followers when I left.
Whoa.
And that means that every time I said something, I was talking to over 2 Barclays Centers.
Oh my God.
Which is fucking psychotic. And there are people with hundreds of thousands of followers. And I don't care about cancel culture. I don't believe it's a thing. It's not, that's not real. It's accountability or whatever. But like, why did I get into this place where I was like, well, everyone really needs to know what I think about like Mayor of Easttown, and I'm gonna like, why did I like get on the mic every day with my opinion? I mean, sometimes I had great jokes.
I'll just chime in to say you have good opinions.
Thank you. Yeah, I think, I mean, look, yeah, all my opinions are right and correct.
I don't think that it's just like a whole misguided thing that you slipped into having like that, not slipped into, that you built this audience. It's like, it's a reflection of your work and your voice and everything. But I know what you're getting at is this thing of like, oh, this is my job and it's eating its way into like my actual soul as a human. And I don't know how to separate that. And that's something like I've certainly wrestled with, but more on Instagram than Twitter.
And it comes in different waves and forms for everybody. It and you realize it too when you have those moments where you're like experiencing something and then you're like, I have to Instagram this, I have to tweet about it, like I have a thought. And taking that away from me was actually a lot easier than I thought it was going to be. I was pulled out of the moment of lots of different things because I was like, I have a joke, I have to make that joke. And every once in a while it's fine, but sometimes I was like, what high am I chasing here, and like, why am I chasing it, and like, could I get it from somewhere else?
I really admire you for stepping away. I think it's really hard. I think that the sad truth, I'm sure you know a lot of people who are like really big on the internet as well, and like a lot of them are on their phones when you're hanging out with them, and they're very far from being present. And I think to even be like wrestling with that as opposed to being swept into it is like a really good a good sign for your survival. I got a flip phone for like 3 months of quarantine.
That. Do you want to tell us about that?
Yeah. So after the election, I was completely just burnt out and exhausted, and it just felt like this like huge marathon was over, and we were just in pieces. Yeah. And I had a lot of limitations on my phone, like timers and things like that, and it really didn't make a difference as far as how I felt, even if I was only on it like I think it was just a cumulative years and years of this relationship with my phone that I really needed a break from.
Yeah.
So I had some realization. Oh yeah. I was writing and I wrote a sentence that clicked with me so much. I just wrote like, my years long practice of sharing my work for the immediate approval or disapproval of thousands of strangers is starting to feel like an illness that I could die from.
Yes. I mean, that's how I quit Twitter. That's it.
I wrote that. I got up and I drove to an AT&T store and I bought a flip phone, and I...
Was it one of those big Firefly phones for senior citizens with the big fire hydrant on it?
There's no fire hydrant, but it was a clunky...
Sure.
I still have it. And so basically I used it for 3 months until my book came out. Okay. And then I kind of switched back to my brain was so...
Oh, back on mic.
Oh, sorry.
No, you're right.
I used it for 3 months. Mm-hmm. And during that period of time, I went through an incredible like separation from that world.
Wow.
And established like a lot. It was just really helpful to learn what it was doing to me.
Yeah.
and learn that I could exist without it, and that it felt really good. And
wow.
It posed a lot of challenges that were only consequential when my life got so busy with my book coming out that I actually couldn't do the extra 10 steps that the phone required of me.
Yeah.
So when my book came out in March, I put my chip back in my my iPhone. But I have had a healthier relationship with my phone.
Wow.
Ever since, because, and I expect that I will reach more breaking points, go back to it.
Sure.
But I highly recommend, if you resonate with the sentence that I said, that it feels like it's something that you,
yes,
is like making you ill. Like,
yes,
it's $100. Like, that's how much the flip phone cost. And it was like completely worth it. It was,
yeah,
really nice to just have an actual, I have a really compulsive and addictive personality, and
yeah,
I don't establish moderation too well. And so having, you know, sending a text, like all these, like only these really basic things that my phone could do was really nice. And it,
wow,
allowed me to get some perspective that even when I came back, I just feel less attached to it. I feel like I have more of a sense of, this isn't me. This,
yeah,
is my job.
Yeah.
I don't have that thing you said where you have to share the joke or you have to share everything.
Yeah.
Like that kind of like healed a little bit.
Yeah,
like,
yeah,
the like scab got to like heal,
yes,
over or,
yeah,
whatever.
Yeah.
So yeah, highly recommend. And like, or if you can do it without buying a new thing, then like,
sure,
please, good for you.
Now, I have to know, did you miss maps? Did you miss navigation?
Maps was honestly, the breaking point was I was driving to like go pick up prints to mail for my book order.
Yeah.
Like I was like running these errands and my book stuff was all happening, and I was fielding, you know, meetings and stuff. And I was like, I cannot do, like, I got lost in Burbank for like half an,
yeah,
hour. And
sure,
I was like, okay, I'm going to go back. But like, this is great.
That is really, I mean, I love, I really relate to like your extremism too. Of like, not only am I just going, like, I'm not just going to delete Instagram off my phone for a little, I'm like going to like literally take this entire thing away from me and then learn how to swim without it. And like,
mm-hmm,
when I need to go back to it, because, yeah, it's very hard just to survive as like a 30 something in a world where every single person has a smartphone. Everyone has email, like you can email someone. I remember getting a smartphone like my senior year of college and like finding out that a class had been canceled like on my way to class. And like that was like mind blowing,
yeah,
to me. Like usually you'd have to go and there'd be a sign that's like class is canceled. And to me, thinking about that now in the world that we've been living in for the last 10 years feels so inconvenient. But at the time, it was just like, that's how you found out. Like, you left your dorm, and if you didn't get the email in time, you'd find out when you got to class.
Yeah.
And I remember, like, looking at my BlackBerry and being like, oh, class is canceled, and being like, whoa. Like, I remember calling my dad and being like, this is insane. Like, I just found out my class is canceled. Like, and I didn't have to go. And, like, it was crazy. But, I mean, we're very reliant on these, like, machines.
We would go to get COVID tests, and I would have to print out my my code. Appointment code or whatever. Yeah. And, like, forgot it a couple times.
Sure.
And there was a lot of things that you take for granted, and the world is not really built for a flip phone. But at the same time, that's why it feels amazing. One of the big things that I observed was that there was a lot of little it wasn't really like the time, you know, if I didn't really have the thing where I was like, oh, usually I'd be in bed scrolling. Like, I didn't really do that, but I would be like in line for bagels, and I would notice when I had my flip phone, like, oh, I'm just like people watching right now, but normally I would just be like checking my email in this line. And there's a lot of moments that you just totally are gone from the world because you're just like, you're choosing to not exist in space for all these little chunks of time, and they really add up. I think that's one of the biggest things I observed, was that we're losing a lot of time that's like 2 minutes here, 30 minutes there, like, you know, that you could just be staring at a leaf.
Yeah.
Why not?
Yeah. You said something about your process of working on directions, and it included smoking some weed.
Mm-hmm.
And I know from your Instagram that your relationship with weed has changed over the last, I don't know, a couple of years or whatever. And you and I are about the same age. So, you know, weed was bad. Druggies, stoner, like a whole thing. And I think now we're kind of growing into this like new wave of being like, you know, the benefits of weed are great, and alcohol is honestly kind of like a way worse drug.
Absolutely.
But I also know that you kind of go into your relationship with weed with like a real I think sense of like your privilege, and just how that affects how you can have a relationship with weed. And I wanted you to come on and talk about weed a little bit, because we've never talked about it on the show.
Yeah.
And I, like, I need you to tell me a little bit about like what that journey has been like for you, because I don't know how many listeners we have who live in states where it's, is it like, is the term legalized or is it decriminalized?
I mean, I think legalized in states means that like, I think you can still be arrested if it's federal.
That's wild.
I don't know, actually. But I don't know the difference between decriminalized and legalized.
But also everyone knows like who's getting arrested for like weed offenses.
Yeah. So, I mean, just to completely preface our conversation, like anytime. So first of all, thanks for having me to come on to talk about weed.
I'm excited.
I have been, you know, in a very not subtle way, I've been really trying to become a weed influencer. It's actually it's the only part of Instagram that I'm trying to really grow. I'm like, you know what?
I like that.
I love
you.
Talking about weed. I love like the sudden, to me feels sudden, where I suddenly feel like, oh, I want to talk about this. I want to be vocal about the fact that I smoke and about the fact that this is part of my life. And part of being vocal about that is acknowledging that I'm a white woman.
Yep.
Black people in this country are almost four times more likely to be arrested for weed, for just smoking weed or selling weed or whatever.
Yeah.
And it's an incredibly fucked up system that started in the 1930s that has fully grown out of racism. And it was just racism from the very beginning. And so I think that learning about that when you're, if you're getting into weed or if you have been getting into weed, like it's really a hand in hand thing to like learn about that as you learn about the plant. So like as you research like what strains you like, also research the history. And there's an organization called the Last Prisoner Project that has a lot of good resources, and there's stuff out there about like the ACLU, and I'm still learning. So this is this is where I'm at. But so that said, it's possible for me to be casual and vocal about weed because I'm white, and it's it's kind of chilling to realize that sometimes.
And then also there's so many people in jail, in
40,000 people.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And also like who it all, you know, obviously all of that kind of crosses over, you know, it intersects into all these different, like the bail might not be that high, but they can't afford it out. So they've just been in jail wait, you know, for like weed offenses or, you know, while now that it's legalized in some of the biggest states, all you see are like these new companies with like great fonts,
which are led and, like, it's majority by white people who have the capital. And there, it's just crazy that like a $1 billion industry is blooming at the same time as there's like thousands of people in jail.
Yeah.
And it's very sad. It's really a horrifying misunderstanding of this plant that it's been twisted into this.
Well, yeah, I mean, like, just all the language around it when we were kids, it was like,
yeah,
oh my god, you're gonna get addicted to weed, like, oh,
so
you can't.
Yeah, so what you were referring to about how it was bad is just like something that was hand in hand with my introduction with weed, was like, we got to be secretive about this. Like,
yeah.
I went to UC Santa Cruz,
yeah,
for 1 year. So my freshman year was a lot about sneaking into the woods, hotboxing the car,
yep,
smoking weed, and being very much like secretive about it. And that was sort of the illicit nature of it was sort of why it had this like enticing
appeal, yeah,
nature. Like, it always agreed with me pretty well, mm-hmm, but it also was, I don't know, yeah, like categorized, I feel like, in my mind, like in this way that was kind of negative.
Like I'm a bad girl.
And
I'm a bad girl,
smoking.
Right, exactly. And it wasn't, yeah, about the high, it was about the action.
And at that time, I didn't think about the fact that I was a white person, no, and had that, like, it was just like completely ignorant of the context. But yeah, so in the last few years, I have had this sort of unfolding realization and change in my relationship with cannabis, where, you know, slowly the laws are changing,
yeah,
and then the narrative in the culture is changing, where people use the word cannabis instead of marijuana.
Yeah.
And, you know, my mom, who cried when she stumbled across my brothers and I smoking weed when we were home from college. Like, I remember her red-eyed, or like, I was red-eyed from weed, she was red-eyed from crying.
Like, what have I done?
It was seriously such a devastating conversation.
Wow.
I remember just,
wow,
the shame of it, and doing something that you know your mom hates that you do.
Mm.
There's something to that.
Yeah.
And so
sure,
so
is.
Years later, my mom grew weed, flipped a full 180.
How does that happen?
She got divorced, bought a house. My brother's friend brought over 6 weed plants and she grew them in her garden. And then she grew,
no,
this so my mom's name is Susie Hopkins. We named the strain Hazy Hopkins. incredible weed. Sad that I smoked all of it. But having my mom give me weed, my mom who once cried about,
yeah,
how sad it was that I,
yeah,
smoked weed, having my mom realize how mistaken that was,
yeah,
and say, here, smoke this,
right, like, wow,
was a
Freaky Friday,
really, really kind of recalibrated my relationship, mm, with it, where I think the experience of smoking that weed really awakened me to, this is not bad, this is not a bad plant, I'm not doing, like, yes, there's obviously, you know, consult your doctor,
right,
if your doctor's chill.
Don't drive.
I'm not telling everyone to just like smoke weed with abandon.
No,
like,
totally,
you have lungs and stuff. But like, but yeah, just like, just being aware that, oh, the government, at least in states, is fine with this now. My mom is fine with this now.
Yeah.
And all of the sort of changing narrative around it has like allowed me to enjoy it way more, and to actually see myself as like someone who has like a really healthy relationship with this substance that, you know, I've been sober from alcohol for 6 years.
Mm.
I'm not really comfortable with most substances because I have a lot of addiction in my family,
mm-hmm,
and the way that cannabis has been for me is just something that feels, somehow, it just doesn't have that hold on me. It feels very like weed is my friend.
Yeah. Weed is my friend.
Yeah.
Do you feel, I have just found one edible, one gummy that I really like after a lot of kind of trial and error of being like, ooh, this makes me anxious. And like, yeah. Dan doesn't really, smoke weed or, eat gummies because he knows it just, it like doesn't vibe with his mental state. And I've been really on a journey because I'm like, I know this could be like great for me, but I have to put in the work to like figure out.
So how. Why did you think it could be great for you even?
Because I have had good experiences.
Okay.
Whereas like with Dan and like other people I talked to who just have never had a good experience like every yeah. time. But that's the thing is that like in high school, you're like, I've said this on the show before. I don't remember in what context, but like you don't know what you're smoking. Like, it's just like some guy
yes.
who's like friends with your friend's brother from college. It's like it could be like a bag of oregano. Like you wouldn't even know because you're like 14. And like the first time I smoked weed was like at a like I'm really boxing myself into like a stereotype, but like at like a Mo concert, like at the Beacon Theater in like the late 90s. Like I was 14, and if my parents are listening, what were you thinking? Why did you let me go to this concert?
And you smoked weed?
Oh yeah, I went in being like, I'm not gonna smoke weed. And like some random, like probably, in my mind, he was like 60, he was probably like 32, but like in my mind, I was like, they're so old, like handed me a joint, and I was like, okay, like I'll
wow.
do it. What was I mean? Like, but because there's so much stigma around, I mean, 14-year-olds probably just waiting a little bit until you're a little older. But like at the time, it's like no one in my life had any sort of relationship with weed. So you only think about it.
Or
as
that
like,
you knew
or
of.
That I knew of.
I exactly. think there's a lot of secret.
I think there were a lot of dads.
Weed smoking boomers out there who only came out recently.
Mm-hmm. If I had my wits about me, I would have assessed the situation and been like, this is not a good place to begin my experimentation with
right.
drugs.
But when something is like contraband,
of
like
course.
You're not even encouraged to go about it in a thoughtful way
no.
because you have to break every rule
yeah.
to attain it.
And
so
this
I
is
just
your
think,
chance.
I mean, it's like the whole, there's just so many reasons to decriminalize it.
Totally. Yeah.
Yeah. Like 14-year-olds, if it wasn't this forbidden thing, I bet 14-year-olds would be a lot more chill about it.
I think in like two generations, we'll have like kids who, I mean, like just sometimes I think about that. Like, I can't wait to be the generation of like really stodgy, like bad opinions. You know what I mean? Because it just means that everyone after us is like more evolved.
Yeah.
Like, even the way that I see, I don't know, like young kids sort of like talk about like gender and pronouns and like.
We're learning from them.
Totally.
Already. Yeah.
Like we were like, oh, yeah, like we know a gay guy and like that's cool with us. And like 11-year-olds now are like, my friend's trans and like, I don't care. And I'm like, wow, like if I was 11, I did not know. But it's because of the exposure and stuff. And it's the same with weed. I think that like, you know, it's not as. It's just a thing that exists now, and I think like the more we go on, it'll be like more recreational, and I think there'll be like more education around, well, this is how it's going to make you feel, and so like, you know, you should be in like X situation when you are using it, or like,
yeah, or like learn, like observe yourself and learn how it works for
right.
you. I think that that's a huge thing that like maybe a lot of people on their first go around with weed like didn't realize they could do.
Yeah.
It's just like, yeah, what if alcohol was like, you never knew whether you were drinking tequila or vodka and you just like drank a bunch
turns
of it.
Turns out it was neither. It was like rubbing
yeah.
alcohol.
Yeah.
From like a Tupperware. Do you know of, before we talk about like what you brought in, more about your relationship with weed, like, is there at all a connection, a reckoning, a advocacy of any of these like aesthetically chic like goopy weed companies and the fact that there are thousands and thousands of black and brown people sitting in cells on
meaning
on
are
things that we would never
is there a movement with. Of those companies to do
yeah.
anything
is there like a you know this is legal and we raised I mean the fact that they're like we raised like millions of dollars from investors to like we like that. I mean, it feels like such a disconnect for me to be like, how could that be possible that people are putting millions of dollars of into
yeah.
this business while there are so many people sitting in jail? But I think if anything that the last year revealed to me that I didn't already know was just so much more of a light on the absolute inequities of this quote unquote system that we have, and how we don't even really try to hide how horrible it
absolutely. Is. Absolutely. Did you hear in about the raids in LA of weed shops where shops that are Apple Store presenting, you know, like you said, goopy weed shops will be raided by the cops, at subject to being raided at any time. The employees, largely black and brown, are arrested and fined.
But why?
And the owners are not fined, because there's, I don't know the minutia. It's basically that because it's still, I think this is why, because it's still federally illegal. So even though it's legal in the states, I mean, Google it.
I'm going to look it up right now.
Everyone do their own research.
No, I'm going to look it up right now while we're talking, and we'll all learn together. Because okay. I just don't understand. Like, I don't understand.
It's this. So
what should I LA weed raid?
I would Google LA weed shop raids.
Okay.
Like, I yeah, just let's don't make sure that we're actually saying
no, that's fine. Yeah. And we're all learning together, too. Okay. Yeah. Illegal weed shops thrive. Okay. So these are quote unquote illegal. They're like unlicensed.
Right. And oh, okay. So I'm kind of remembering now.
This is from late 2019. Does that sound right to you?
I think it's been ongoing. Okay, I heard a radio story recently.
Okay.
But basically the way that you have a weed shop in this city is...
In Los Angeles,
is that you have to have had you have to have the right permit, and then you have to have a physical shop that has been able to be open for years without being able to sell anything. So the only people that can have legal weed shops are people who have so much money, who have so
they
much
could pay the rent on a store that
yeah
wasn't,
that they can that they can that they can have a because yeah. all the permit rules change every couple of years, so like only a few shops have like slipped through, and then all these other ones are illegal, and then their employees get arrested while nothing happens to the owners.
But I don't understand, like, and I'm not asking, I'm just saying this out loud, like, that makes it just makes no sense to me. But I understand, like, why would it make sense to me? Nothing has ever been fair. Nothing has ever been equal.
None of it makes sense.
Right. It all comes back to the wealth gap, the education gap, the way that, you know, the government advocates for constituents or doesn't, rather. Illegal weed dispensary raided by LA police. So I understand. So Basically, it all comes down to, like, do you have a license, which costs a lot of money? Do you have a permit, which costs a lot of money? Do you have the storefront that's registered, which we will... Because a lot of the weed stuff... And I think this was a big incentive for New York to pass it to be legal, is this idea that all of the taxes will then go back into, I don't know, the economy, like, the, you know, it'll help pay for things.
I think the idea is that the taxes are supposed to pay for the communities who've been damaged by the criminalization of weed. Right. Or
at I'm giving least, you a look that says, really, no, is that really going to happen?
Yeah, exactly. Supposed to. So when you asked if anyone's doing anything, the answer is I don't know about I haven't heard of like. A weed shop or anything that's been radically active. I know there's a black owned shop called Pharmacy up in Oakland, and there's really, you know, amazing stuff going on, but I think there's a lot of just legal level rules that exclude people of color and just make it so that nothing happens. And so I think when states are legalizing weed, they have to plug into the legislation that, you know, these permits for having things will be, you know, leaned toward people of color. Like, they have to like make it, you know, skew, but I don't, you know, it's hard to trust people to do that.
Obviously. No, I mean, and I'm reminded of living in Brooklyn. You know, when you at Atlantic Avenue, there was always a woman selling churros, like from a cart or whatever. And they were great. And I would get them more than
love a churro.
Like, honestly, like every Friday, it was like churro day for me. And I remember, like, you know, that's a vendor. You need a license to do that. No one on the consuming end gives a shit. And also, like, it's New York, like, you've seen everything. You know, and you're not aware of, I don't know, the license thing is like bullshit to me.
Yeah.
But that's how they'll get black and brown people is like, oh, you don't have a permit to sell church. Like, who are you hurting?
Yeah.
But it's an excuse. And so what I'm hearing now from the weed raids is like, well, it's not about the weed. It's about the fact that you needed to do all this paperwork and it cost $1,200 to do the paperwork and you needed to register and that cost $500 and we know you can't afford it. So we now know that we can still target.
Yeah.
You.
So just to kind of like give context to this, like none of this is accidental. Like of this course. Is all from, so there's this guy who was the like dude who spearheaded marijuana illegalization back in the 1930s. His name was Harry Anslinger. Mm-hmm. And he was just an enormous piece of shit.
Great.
Who
awesome.
Was super racist. He was like at the head of alcohol prohibition. So when prohibition ended, he used marijuana illegalization to be the new like cudgel against any, you know, people of color, immigrants, and just like was a huge part of building up hysteria about marijuana. And there was all this science that was saying, oh, weed, we did this really advanced study and weed makes people giggly, a little sleepy. Like it does these things that actually there was like evidence that it could help heal from hard drug addiction. And that there was actual scientific evidence that was saying that weed had all these sort of innocent or promising qualities. Mm. And he was just like, no, no, no. He presented this list of crimes to Congress that was called the Gore Files, where he presented 200 crimes that were committed under the influence of marijuana. And he was really sending this message that if you smoked marijuana, you were going to murder people. And they were going to like, and later they looked into those crimes and they were fabricated. It's like,
of course,
it was all a ploy to keep black and brown people down. This dude like hated jazz and hated jazz musicians and was very like threatened by how popular it was. And he just like truly is the grandfather of all the,
right now.
He's the grandfather of all the horrors that have taken place and people going to jail for it and having minimum sentences. Like he planted the seeds of all that garbage.
Okay.
So all of this is sort of descending from something that was so messed up from the very beginning that we have so much work to do in not just bailing people out and
but
changing
like
the laws. We have to change the reason I want to talk about it more and the reason I've like posted a photo of myself smoking weed on Instagram is like, the laws have to change and people's minds have to change. Like I feel like my art is like pretty wholesome and I want people to know that I'm a wholesome ass person who smokes weed and those things go together.
Yeah.
Like those things are not exclusionary.
Yeah.
Like that's part of my life and my process and it's not unhealthy.
Right.
It's actually quite, you know, positive for me. And it's not this thing that I'm, you know, descending into a hellscape of drug addiction.
Sure.
Like, no, I color with crayons. Yeah. I smoke weed and I color with crayons on construction paper.
It's very wholesome.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
I also think that there's a really great opportunity from a medical perspective to, you know, science is ever changing, as we've learned this year. I've never been more connected with the world of science than I think in 2020. Most people will probably agree. But the idea that, like, you know, there's a whole generation of doctors that were fed, you know, medical research that I'm sure was flawed in a lot of ways. And part of me thinks that there probably are, there's so many pharmaceuticals out there. There's so many people on different types of drugs. Weed is always the thing that's demonized, but, you know, prescription pills are like a problem.
Isn't that hilarious that my psychiatrist was like, oh my God,
I'd rather
smoke.
You on Klonopin.
Yeah. I mean, and what you said earlier about alcohol, like when I quit alcohol, I was like, there's no good outcome with alcohol. Yeah. Like, and respect to everyone who enjoys it. Yeah. Like, I have friends that it works well for them. But for me, I'm like, I just don't see how this goes well.
Yeah.
I don't see a path where this goes well. And like, it's so you like, there's a liquor store in every corner. And yet when weed comes into the picture,
it's
so sensational. Yeah. And it's just, it's a very funny sort of ironic.
It's crazy.
World.
I just love more information. Like, they really should be testing now weed against also like different antidepressants and stuff, because like, that wasn't done. Like, you weren't, you have there.
We're missing all the research
because now that it's legalized, there are so many people like you and in some ways like me who are now introducing it into your routine. But I'm already on, you know, a Xanax, a Zoloft, Ritalin, and it's like, I would love my doctor to be able to be like, to not go into it and be like, this is bad because it's weed, but be like, hey, like, there are some properties here that like, if in XYZ situation, you might XYZ.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the kind of information I'd like to know. And that's what I think the doctors don't even have that info on, because they're like, well, we're not doing research on like, it, like, I think their kind of mentality is like, well, it's a legal drug, so if you're taking it,
which means that people don't tell their doctor about it. Yeah.
Like, I would love to know more about like, hey, like, if I've just taken my daily Ritalin and which is an upper, an absolute literal speed in my body, and then I take like a gummy, like, what's happening in my brain? Because
you have to be the scientist of yourself.
Right.
You have to do all the testing on Caroline, the like, guinea pig.
Yeah. And it's like, right, exactly. Done by trial and error, which I don't know that I want to do that. And it's so, it's like, I want a weed chill doctor that can be like, hey, in like ABC situation, like, you might just want to pull back. And it's not because like there's anything wrong with weed, but it's because, hey, here's what you've just put into your body.
Yeah.
And I think really quickly too, and I know, I don't know if this is your experience with psychology, psychiatry, where they're the ones who can prescribe you the drug. Sometimes it's like a 5-minute conversation, like, oh, you're sad, you're not feeling good, not feeling depressed. Okay, I'm going to prescribe you this drug. And you're like, oh, okay.
No, it's completely,
I mean, I'll take it, but like also
fast
like
fast food. Yeah.
What? Like, could you tell me some more? Like, I'm very pro drugs, pro antidepressants, pro everything. But I also feel that there's like a lot I don't know about what I'm putting into my body totally. Every day. And not in like a, like, I want holistic, like, only natural stuff, but like I'd love to know what this does to my brain.
Yeah.
And if I feel too intimidated to say to my doctor like, well, I'm also high half the day, and if that could change, and if he's like, oh, well, in that case, let's do this differently. Mm-hmm. I'd love to know that. But I feel like you're either in a position where you're like, I can't tell my doctor I smoke weed, or if I tell my doctor I smoke weed, he's just going to be like, well, you know, that's bad for you, please don't do that anymore, kind of like the situation
yeah.
I had. It just feels like there needs to be like a lot more.
I would recommend for anyone who is, as we are, stuck in the situation of having to experiment on yourself, start really small. Like, don't like pop a whole brownie and yeah. just see like, even I just love like, if you're smoking something that you haven't smoked before or whatever, like take a puff and like wait 20 minutes and
yeah.
just like see how you feel.
Yeah.
And then like go from there. And like, actually my husband Jack is kind of doing a purposeful examination of how he feels on weed, and like is taking notes to like make sure that nice. He remembers that like, oh, this thing makes me anxious.
Yeah.
And we actually had a funny realization that spurred that off, because we smoked a bunch of weed throughout quarantine, and then we kind of realized like let's cool it, like stop for a couple weeks, kind of like see what's up.
Yeah.
And at the end of a couple weeks, Jack was like, all right, well, I've noticed that I am much less socially anxious and more productive when I'm not smoking weed. So weed was giving him anxiety and like distracting him.
Yeah.
And my main realization was, I am less productive and more anxious.
Sure.
And other than that, I just miss weed.
Yeah.
And that was like my main consequence.
Yeah.
But it was also really cool to learn that. I'm like, oh, sweet.
Our
like,
brains are all different. I mean, yeah. that's why some of us have to take.
And we were smoking the same weed, by the way.
Exactly.
So like, I think that you just have to realize that like I have friends for whom weed is a hallucinogen.
Yeah.
So it's very different for different people.
Yes.
And I think that like if you don't, like, if it, some people just doesn't agree with you, it freaks you out, just don't even worry about it. Don't smoke it. But if you want to see if it works for you, like, try different stuff, like, write down what you try, and then, like, be very small quantities and, like, gentle about it, so that you don't, like, edibles especially are very easy to misdose, and you can, like I've had
literal candy.
I've had a very bad trip off of off of that.
So. Yeah, same.
Yeah,
and I'll, there's some that make me super paranoid. I remember I took this gummy. I loved the taste, and so that's why I was like, okay, I'm into this. But the it yielded bad results. Like, immediately, I became very paranoid, and not in like a scary, like, alarming way, but in a, like, it was during quarantine. We had been playing Mario Kart on Zoom. So we would be, we were on Zoom with our friends and we were all playing Mario Kart together. And I started the, I took a gummy, popped a gummy like 5 minutes before the conversation. So yeah, the waiting is the game. A half hour into this, I started feeling it. And almost immediately I was like, everyone's mad at me.
Oh,
they're so mad at me. And Dan was like, stop, no weed, no weed for you. Cause like immediately I was just like, No one's paying attention to you.
Aww.
But then I got a little bit more experimental, found something that I really liked. And now I know, like, I don't take it during the day. I take it at night. Helps me wind down, helps me go to bed. Like, that's how it works for me. Excellent. But, and right, not all weed is created equal. And now we're at this kind of interesting point where, like, if you've never been into a dispensary in California, it is not. And the first time I went into one, I had my mind blown by the experience, because I kind of had in my mind what it was going to be like, which is, I thought it was just like weed grocery store and you're on your own. It's very like, hello, and what are you
They're
looking for?
They're called bud tenders, yeah. Which I think is so cute.
The bud tenders. It's like going into Kiehl's where they're wearing the lab coats, and you're like, you're not a doctor. Tell me what I need to put on my skin. But you can literally like verbalize like, hey, like this is kind of my personality, like here's my last couple experiences, like, or if something specific didn't work for you, like the when I ended up with this brand that I liked, and I can't remember the name of it, but I'll find out, it was because I literally pointed to the thing that made me paranoid and I was like, this did not do it for me. And he was like, oh, interesting, okay, like let's go in a different direction. This is not high school where you're at the mercy of the baggie of someone's brother's friends cousins.
Those days are gone.
You can have some ownership.
For that same reason, store-bought weed is really strong. It's stronger than a lot of weed that like someone grew. So I always have to like be pretty careful about that stuff.
Because
it's just like, it's potent.
I'm very much into the gummy life. I know you brought some stuff that you've been enjoying lately. I want to hear about it. Hallie, what did you bring? What weed-related item did you bring to the show? I'm very excited.
Yeah. I brought my raw hemp plastic cigarette rolling machine.
Wow.
Which
it's very tiny. It's sitting on my desk right now. It sounds like the KitchenAid for weed, but it's very, very small. What does it do?
It's hilarious that it's called a machine, and I actually never knew the name until I was bringing it in. I never knew the name of it because I've just had it. It is a little contraption with like a fabric or like a vinyl belt that it's really hard to describe, but basically it becomes like a little row for you to like put your
like
weed and your filter
scroll,
in
like a Torah almost.
So it's this funny little contraption that helps you roll beautiful joints.
Cool.
And I'm very much in a joint loving phase right now. I used to smoke out of pipes, but now I just like love having like a little J with me.
Sure.
And, I love this machine. It allows you to just roll, you can roll like an herbal cigarette if you want, you can you can like have a different filter, buy a fun rolling paper, and just like have your own joints that don't look like shit. One of my best stoner friends was, we were smoking weed and she had this terrible joint, and I was like, what, this joint sucks? And she was like, well, I don't really know how to roll joints, and the only time I have good ones is when I'm like with a guy who rolls them for me. And I was like, oh, I'm sending you this. So I sent her a raw hemp plastic cigarette rolling machine.
How much does it cost?
It costs $4.22.
Wait, it costs $4.22.
They missed an opportunity.
Someone made a grave error. I think it absolutely should be 420. Something happened. We probably should write to them.
Yeah. But hopefully they're listening to this.
Yeah,
episode.
It's kind of when I was looking around my little weed setup, I ended up selecting this, even though there's a lot of things I'm passionate about in my weed setup, because joints have been so fun to just have this little like process similar to making coffee I think that a lot of people who smoke weed enjoy this, like the ritual of
the doing.
You grind your weed and then you roll your joint and you have your little paper, and then like sometimes I'll roll like three of them for the week and then I have them in a little holder.
Like meal
and
planning.
Yeah, exactly.
That's so cool. Yeah. So do you put the I'll show you everybody a picture. I'm not gonna be able to describe this. It's like
we could even do a demonstration.
Do you have stuff to do a demonstration?
I do, yeah, I do.
Oh my gosh. I would, you know what we'll do?
Because it does, I will say, this little machine, it takes a second to figure out how to do it.
Yeah.
But once you have it down, it's lovely and easy, and it's one thing that's been really fun is like having people over, especially in COVID. I would roll guests a joint with like,
you're a bud tender,
instead of like, because usually like you lick the joint to like, oh sorry, usually you lick the joint to make it seal or whatever, and I would like, to be COVID safe, I would like use like a wet paper towel and then just have like a nice little joint there for a guest.
Nice.
I am a bartender.
That is like making someone like a drink.
Yeah. Yeah.
I would love to. We will do a demonstration. What I will do is after we're done recording, we will film it and then we'll put it on Reels. Because if we do a demonstration, all you're going to hear is me going, oh, and you will learn nothing from that. So that's amazing. Yeah. The thing about edibles for me that's always been like, the inviting thing is like, it's very on my level. Like I can open this thing. It's already pre-dosed.
My mom is very into edibles.
This feels like it would behoove me. I don't know if I could roll a joint, but you're right. Like this is a tool that would help you.
Yeah. I've seen people roll joints just with their hand or with a chopstick. Mm. Like there's many ways that people get around it, but I'm like, you can make classy little cigs.
Yeah.
Classy little J's.
That's cool. And where did you find it? At a dispensary or like... Can you buy like?
I can't remember a time when
yet?
I didn't have it.
Oh, okay.
I don't remember buying it. It actually came out of the womb with me.
Yeah, it's like when you're like, well, I don't know the first time I ever heard "Row, Row, Row Your Boat." I just was born knowing "Row, Row, Row Your Boat." Hallie was born with the joint roller. Can you buy this kind of stuff online yet, or is
it is on Amazon because it's a cigarette rolling machine. So I think Raw. I don't really know much about them, but Raw is like they make rolling papers, they make filters, I think they're in the cigarette game,
sure.
But overlap with cannabis. And yeah, I'm a big fan
Very
of their
cool.
product.
And $4.22 feels like a steal. This feels also like something that give it a year and there are going to be, and I mean, I'm sure they already exist, but I'm just not in that world yet. Like there are much more expensive versions.
Like fancy
of this.
Versions.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah. And I've actually tried I've tried a couple different things. Like there's one that like you put some stuff in and it like spits out a perfectly rolled joint, but it didn't
work.
Like
the Easy Bake Oven.
Like it claimed to do that, but it didn't work. Like I don't think you need anything fancier than this, to be honest. Like I'm very, very into it. The little paper thing.
Yeah.
You can replace it. Like it gets kind of like sticky after a while. Like you'll like replace it. Like this is made of hemp plastic, which I think is cool. Cause
that's awesome.
Yeah.
I'm imagining it like being one of those infomercials for like an air fryer where like it would totally get me. You know what I mean? It's like just put the weed in the paper and then it like spits out this perfect joint, because like every time I see an infomercial for an air fryer, I'm like, oh my God, how did
but,
it do that?
Yeah. The promise is a bit,
of course,
inflated. I think
it's simplistic.
It's
too.
Very simplistic. That's why I think the word machine is very funny.
Yeah.
Because it's like, it's like calling a shovel a machine.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah, that's so true. There's nothing. Battery operated. Mm-mm. You don't charge it. It's literally a piece of plastic with some paper wrapped around it strategically, and it is a machine. Wow, very cool.
Yeah, it's lovely.
I've never rolled a joint before, so now we'll have to figure. I mean, you're gonna have to show me.
I'll give you a little lesson.
I'm really excited.
This is honestly, my friend who I sent one to loves it. She rolls her own joints now.
But this is the kind of thing that this new wave is like opening up. And which it makes me so annoyed and sad and furious that like people are in jail for
for this kind of stuff when you and I are sitting around being like, let's do a reel. Oh, it's for really, the podcast.
It's such a cute little cigarette rolling machine.
It. Yeah.
It really feels like, I mean, privilege creates an alternate reality.
Right.
And we are in this alternate reality. And it's so bizarre to see how, you know, there's billboards all across LA that are advertising these weed shops. And like, it's just become like,
you can get weed delivery in LA. You can get weed delivery.
You know, advertising companies are like creating campaigns for weed companies. And it's like, it feels very like we are living in an alternate reality. 100%. And it's like, shouldn't the flip side of every billboard be about like cannabis justice? Or like, shouldn't there be, I don't know.
These advertising companies paying for, you know, these bails or, you know, like, I don't know. I just think about this kind of stuff and more aware of it in the last year than ever, you know, kind of always had my own privilege, especially in the last like 5 or 6 years, moving out of, no, that would be 10 years, but like, you know, leaving kind of the bubble in which I grew up, meeting different kinds of people, different backgrounds, different races, different genders. Like, obviously, like anything else, the more you're exposed to, the more normal it becomes. So, you know, until I moved to New York City, really, I didn't really know anybody who had a different story than I had. Like,
right.
And it is nuts to, especially in the last year, I think with all of the conversation around privilege and around also this idea that white people for a long time, the most important thing to convey to people was like, I'm not racist. Like, I don't see color, like blah, 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 blah. That's what we were taught in school. And the racist part is not saying like, hey, that person over there is black. The racist part is saying like, no, we're exactly the same, and ignoring their reality, which is like extremely different from my own.
I think that's the piece of it that so many are missing.
Yeah.
The piece of it that says what racism is.
Yeah.
Like, that it's like a fundamental misunderstanding of racism isn't just that you're screaming a slur.
Yeah.
It's that you don't have to worry about most
it's
shit.
The systemic part,
yeah,
of the systemic racism talk.
Harry Anslinger was fucking wrong.
Yeah.
Why don't we take that note and run with
right.
it? Like, oh, we made a mistake shaping everything around this guy's racist intention.
I have this open on my phone, and if you guys didn't catch it in the beginning of the episode, you really should go look at these Gore files, because the idea, like Hallie said, like, he just made up or like fabricated or like exacerbated this idea that like weed made people
murderous, violent.
Some of the things he said were, under the evil influence of medical marijuana, a man under the influence of the drug attempted to shoot his wife, killed her grandmother instead, then committed suicide. A man, 25 years old, assaulted a 10-year-old girl. Then he was pled not guilty because of insanity. He was sentenced to death. A young boy became addicted to smoking weed, not a thing. Killed his father, mother, two brothers, and a sister.
Oh, my
like,
God.
It's like, that has nothing to do with weed. Like, there are a lot of other things to explore here. It's not weed.
It's, well, yeah, it's all shit he made up. And it's just trying, and it worked. He was trying
it's
to
fear.
Build up fear to
yeah.
the point where people would back him. And Congress ended up, like, passing his legislation regardless that it didn't make sense,
right?
And there was so much scientific evidence to refute what he was saying. And actually there was a guy who was in a position to block that and block something on terms of like, oh, this shouldn't be criminalized, and like Nixon fired him and was just like, oh, never, no. Like, there's just been a lot of people trying to to stop it or say the right thing. And as we've experienced with Trump, it's like fear wins. Like,
fear
oh
wins.
Get lather up
agenda.
The fear
mm-hmm.
and like people will react, and that's like shaped everything we're dealing with.
Yeah, everything really has to change, and it can't just be about, oh, we're allowed to smoke weed now. And just like everything, like there's history to all of these situations we find ourselves in. And I think that's why when people say like, oh, the system is broken, and other people say actually it's working as intended, is because it is working as intended. Like, this
exactly.
is never, like, people are not held to the same standards when they're charged for the same crime. And there's a world of history and evidence that that's true. I would never be in jail for weed, even when it was illegal. I just know that. And you would never be in jail
You'd
for
be given
weed.
The absolute benefit of the doubt.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
They said, I think I was just about to say something really I heard that was really prophetic, and I realized it came from Law and Order, where everything comes from. But it was like when white kids commit crimes, when white underage, like under 18 kids commit crimes, they're immediately sent to like a therapist or a psychologist. And when black kids commit crimes, they're tried in court and sent to juvie and basically labeled criminals. And it's true. No one, I don't know anybody who's ever gotten in trouble with the law for things that they should have gotten in trouble for. And they're all white.
I mean, that's just what it is. Right.
This was such an enlightening episode, and I'm so happy we did it, because weed is not something that we have covered on the show.
Oh, I'm so glad to introduce it.
I can't wait to, you guys can check out we're going to put it up on Instagram, the reel of Hallie showing us how to use the machine. Again, could not describe it for you. That's not in my skill set.
Maybe like it looks kind of like a bed, like a little bed for a mouse. Yeah. that has like a bit like a badly built bed for a mouse.
A badly built bed for a mouse is exactly right. And when you go to look at the picture, you'll be like, that's true.
A mouse would hate sleeping there.
We will link to like everything we talked about, especially all of this really interesting information about Henry or Harry?
Harry Anslinger.
And the Gore files and sort of how all of this happened. And I'll also try to find some information about the wealth gap and all of those rules about buying property, because when I learned that, my mind was blown. And then I was like, why is my mind blown? This should not be surprising. More importantly, Directions, Hallie's latest book, is on sale wherever you get books. Do you have a independent bookstore you want to shout out that people should buy from?
Well, I love Skylight. If you're in LA, there's signed copies there.
Nice.
It's a really nice store to go browse in if you want to experience the world again. But yeah, I just encourage anyone to shop at an indie store if you can. But if you can't, no worries.
Awesome. Hallie, thank you so much for coming. This was really wonderful. Again, her book Directions, and then her other book that she wrote with her mom, Hazy Hopkins, which I'll now just call her from now on, What to Do When I'm Gone, is just so beautiful. It's actually, I got this from my mom for Mother's Day, and then I also bought a copy for myself. It's really, really wonderful. But again, you know, bite by bite, when you're emotionally ready, it is very
moms get very subject always brings up a lot. For literally anyone. So
we all have that in common. That's what makes the world go round.
It's universal.
Our mommy issues. Hallie, thanks for coming. It was so nice to have you.
Thank you for having me. I'm a big fan of the show, so it's an honor.
Thank you. All right, you guys, everything will be linked, and we'll see you guys next week for another episode of G Things Just Bought It. Make sure that you go to the G Things Instagram if no other time, then next Thursday, when we will be doing a $2 Thursday to advocate for those who are still being punished for weed crimes, because it's bullshit. So we will see you then, and thanks for joining us.